Hey, welcome to the Meat House. Jeff here with my buddy Chris.
Hey, Jeff, how you doing today?
I am doing pretty good. I mean, we are into the summer. It's a little hot and humid in the recording studio today, but
it's a bit warm.
We have some mead. Maybe that'll cool us down.
Now, if not, at least I won't mind as much.
There you go.
I'll say, well, you know, it's been a great summer so far. I mean, we've had a lot of rain, which is good because I have a garden. Everybody knows that now.
Right.
And I actually got you your bags today.
Yeah, you did.
Grow bags. I hope you like them. And now you know what 20, 25 gallons is.
Yeah, that's a...
They're huge.
Mm-hmm. That is a substantial amount of space that I was not occupying with dirt. So, good to know.
Good to know. And I even brought you one of the terracotta plant spikes they use for the water bottle, wine bottle things. They're cool. They're not that expensive. They work good.
Yeah, no, I'm going to have to... I'm probably going to get more than one of those some point soon.
Yeah. Before we start here, let's thank our listeners.
Absolutely, guys.
Great people. Love having you guys come here and spend time with us as we sit back, talk mead, try to give you a little bit of information that might help you out. And if you have any questions, comments, by all means, please let us know what you need to know, because we are more than glad to share.
Absolutely. Drop us a line on Facebook or info@themeathouse.com. We are, as usual, pretty pretty chill and pretty happy to correspond and chat. And, you know, you got questions, you need answers, that's what we're here for.
That's what we're here for. And the best part about it is you're going to find out in the mead community, it's a lot like being a mason or a chef. There really are no secrets. We're going to help you out.
No, the biggest problem you're going to have is if you ask five people for a solution, you're going to get six answers.
Yeah,
you
know? Seven, maybe. Yeah.
there is an overabundance of opinion and information available to you.
Yeah, so. That's true. But anyway, and the other one you need to thank is Box and Barley Corn.
Absolutely.
They have been great to us. They are, I swear, almost every time I go in there, I see something that they say has been there before, but I haven't seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always ready to help you, always good people. It's cider season for them.
Yes.
It's cider season. They've been doing a lot of ciders.
They just got a contract with Lewisburg, he was telling me. So they've got, not only do they have Lewisburg's like regular
apple cider
that I use personally.
Oh, yeah, me too.
But they also have like the pear and the cherry and all kinds of other stuff.
Holy cow.
Like,
I mean, I didn't know Lewisburg had those.
This is news to me. Because,
yeah, I mean.
Like.
And once more, we step into another part of our rabbit hole.
Right.
Here we go. Anyway, so give them a call, and if you have any information, if you need anything, they probably got it or can get it for you. And if you'd like to get a little bit of a discount, MHP10.
That's our discount code. That gets you 10% off anything you buy. Their prices are already competitive as hell, and the extra 10% just sweetens the deal for you.
Yeah, and it's right. And then also let them know that you're listening to us, and they've made a good investment. We appreciate that. So our meat of the day is actually one I made. Now, a couple weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago, I don't remember exactly. We tried a blueberry cinnamon. And at that time, I had just, a few weeks before that, bottled a blueberry cinnamon of my own making. And so I brought that here today. And, you know, I like it, but I'm going to have Jeff tell you what he thinks of it, as, you know, being more astute than I am in this.
Fair.
So, this is a test batch for me. I made a 1 gallon batch. I did not run it through a filter. Because it's 1 gallon. I'm not going to go through filter pads for a gallon.
Well, you know, I never filter anything. I just fine, and that's fine with me.
Yeah. And it works.
Yeah.
It's a little hazy.
Yeah, it is hazy. But that's not a big deal. We are home winemakers. We're not going to snob each other here. It's got kind of a, what do I want to call this? Like a prickly pear kind of pink color. And there is cinnamon on the nose for sure.
Oh, yeah. I use cinnamon sticks, not cinnamon powder.
Okay. Do you know whether you used actual cinnamon or cassia?
I actually used cinnamon.
Okay.
I got it from the Middle Eastern market in the city.
Nice.
And it's just cinnamon.
Yeah, I'm hurting to find the blueberry behind the cinnamon. The cinnamon is potent.
Yeah, honestly, I only left it in there for 3 days. But it was a gallon, so I probably should have done less.
Well, yeah.
I can taste a little blueberry, though.
Yeah, the blueberry is there by flavor. It's just not there by smell. And the cinnamon is a little strong. It's not overpowering. It has a little, you know, that it's not like the capsaicin burn, but it's that cinnamon kind of tingle.
Yeah.
The one that's like overemphasized in red hot candies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You get a little bit of that, especially like not at the tip of your tongue when you're drinking it, but at the tip of your tongue after you've swallowed and everything's kind of settling out.
Yeah. But I like this one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I grant you I can use less cinnamon in my next round.
Maybe just a little bit. Yeah. I think the amount of cinnamon isn't excessive. It's just high.
Mm-hmm. But at least I kept the blueberry in there. And this is semi-sweet. And it's a 14. 14 ABV.
Mm-hmm. How much in terms of blueberry did you get in there?
I actually put 5 pounds of blueberry in the 1 gallon batch.
Okay.
And there was straight up blueberry.
Mm-hmm.
Frozen, mashed, in a bag.
Well, it's a good amount of blueberry to it, too.
So, but I did come across an old recipe you did a long time ago on a show that had blueberries and blueberry puree.
Hmm.
At the time, you guys said it was like drinking blueberry juice. And it was, what, they said something like 19% alcohol. And everybody was saying, how did you do that?
Well, that was provided by one of our guests. I think I listened to that episode. I don't remember exactly the circumstances of that, but that's way in the background of the episode. Chris has been kind of getting into the archive on a website and into our back catalog here.
I'm trying to catch up. Let's just be real. I mean, this was here a long time before I came along, and mm-hmm. I have a lot to catch up.
Well, yeah. No, the cool thing is that a lot of the stuff we talked about back in the day, there are new and interesting ways to do it now as opposed to then, too. So,
yeah. Technology moves on, and it's, you know, and I'm not going to keep up, but I don't mind keeping abreast.
Yeah. And it, you know, in worst case, you listen to a random old episode and find a cool recipe we liked, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, no harm, no foul.
I actually wrote that recipe down. It's on my board.
Anyway, what are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about there's a problem in your meat, you have a fault, mm-hmm. and how to correct it.
Right.
Now, so, we've touched on this lightly before.
Yeah, I think today we're doing like a deep dive into faults, and I'm kind of, just as a general framework, I'm using the BJCP Meat Study Guide for like what the faults are and what to look for, because I think it's fairly exhaustive as a list.
Mm-hmm.
If you guys think that there's something I'm missing or something that is not, that I'm thinking kind of ropes into one of these categories and doesn't, feel free to shoot us an email. Tell us.
Missed this.
Right. I'm Jeff. You're dumb. I'm going to argue with you, but that's life.
So. I'm probably going to argue with them. You're one of the smartest people I know. I read your master's dissertation 5 times. I kind of understood it the 5th time. It was anyway, but no, if we miss something, tell us. We'll be glad to go over it in a future episode. Anyway, so what do you got for faults on your list?
So the first fault they list, this is going alphabetical order, and that's just an easy way to organize things, right?
Polyacidic?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, not acidic. Acetic.
Acetic, okay.
Acetic is, it's vinegar. It's the acetic acid is the stuff you buy at the store. Vinegar you buy in the store is a 4 to 5% acetic acid content.
Okay.
If you're buying it as a like a weed or insecticide kind of a thing, like the plant friendly, earth friendly kind of stuff, you can get it, I think, up to 20%, and it will freaking burn stuff.
Okay.
I at some point or another I used something called Blackjack, which is vinegar, just very concentrated vinegar, at my mother-in-law's house to try and control some like ivy that was growing up her back fence. And I think it kind of worked, but it, you know, it's no Roundup.
Well, you know, ivy's also a tough plant to get rid of. It's stubborn.
Yeah. It's real, really stubborn. Anyway, so
acetic.
Acetic is, it's vinegar. And what do you think, where do you think you get acetic from?
Is it caused by distillation process or is it caused by
not distillation? We're not usually distilling.
I know, that's why I don't know where you get that flavor though.
Usually, that is a secondary infection of Acetobacter.
Okay, gotcha.
So you know the same way that people they'll put a vinegar mother in some cider or some wine to make, you know, red wine vinegar or cider vinegar or whatever. Mm-hmm. That natural like bacterial colony can also just appear. And it's kind of like yeast. Wild yeast is on everything. Wild Acetobacter family stuff. That's everything too. And
so it's an extra bacterium that's in your fermentation process.
Right. You can get that in unclean equipment. You can get that on like fruit skins. You can get that in just if your airlock runs dry and there's air contact in there.
Okay.
Especially if there's air contact in there, because the Acetobacter like line of organisms is generally aerobic, and so they need oxygen.
Gotcha.
If you're getting oxygen contamination, whether it's like your airlock dried out over the winter and you had a little gap that, had air contact, you're getting both the oxygen through that, like a little bit of airflow, just in the change of temperatures and things like that. But you're also getting the bacteriums that are kind of going along with it.
Okay.
And
So how would we get rid of a vinegar flavor in our mead?
you don't, unfortunately.
Okay.
You kind of have to lean into that and make some fancy vinegar. Or, well, there are a few choices. I've had, it's not exactly vinegar, but it's kind of a sour, sharpish flavor in I want to say it was a tart cherry mead that I just found delightful. And I caught it kind of fairly early, so it wasn't that strong. So I just stabilized it and said, hey, here's the sour cherry. And
Okay, so
my wife hated it. I loved it. A couple of our friends really liked it. A couple of our friends didn't, but it was a 1 gallon batch, so F it.
that's what you draw batches for.
It's ten, like little 10 little 12 ounce bottles, and you're done.
Yeah. So okay, good.
The
So
thing you
is
have to realize is that the acetic fault, you don't correct it, you prevent it.
okay. You have to prevent this one. It's
Right. So this
and
one you're preventing by, good practices, cleaning, sanitizing, using those all the time. You have to be careful with what you're putting in there as far as, fruit, spices, different additions, making sure that those are not a vector for the infection stage, and keeping your oxygen post fermentation
out of
very
your
low.
batch, yeah. Okay, excellent. So, is this different from like okay, couple of episodes ago, we talked about my son's test meads for cheap mead, and we said one of them had more diesel flavor. Is that the same thing?
Not at all, not at all.
Okay.
We will get to that kind of hot alcohol flavor a little bit later.
Okay, I just want to see. I make sure there's a difference here.
No,
This is just straight vinegar.
this is a vinegar flavor. We know that there are a number of different like fancy vinegars, along with like the basic white vinegar you can get at the supermarket. But they all kind of, if you get past the extra flavors, they all have that kind of acetic acid kind of vinegary flavor that just hits your tongue or your nostrils as, oh yeah, that's vinegar.
Okay.
So
Okay.
next one though is pretty similar. That's acidic.
Okay. Well,
That's
okay. That's what I thought we were doing, but my alphabetizing in my head wasn't the
So acidic is kind of just exactly what it says on the tin. Too
Yeah.
much acid.
Too much acid.
How do you think we get too much acid in a meat?
Too little sugar. I know you do it. You can get counter it by sweetening a bit.
You can tone it down by sweetening. Too much is always going to be too much. So you can, we talk about the balance of those, the three legs of the table, the sweet, the tannin, and the acid. And if you can bring up the tannin and the sweet to kind of bring that into control, unless it's just too much acid right out the bat. How do you think acid gets into meat, though, in a general sense?
Again, no clue at this moment.
Most of the time, you're getting acid in the mead from your honey and from fruit.
Why honey?
Honey has acid in it.
Fair
And it's
enough.
not something you think about when you taste honey like regularly because it's sweet as all get out, right?
It's as I think my son called it super saturated sugar.
Basically, yeah, it's a naturally created sugar syrup with some extra stuff in it. And the extra stuff means just why we like it. But one of those extra things in it is acid.
Okay.
There's actually a substantial amount of it, and it really, depending on the varietal, you can have more or you can have less too. That's part of the nature of using nectar for the basic like the building block of that. That's part of the nature of using, a natural
Source.
source as the building block of the honey.
Okay.
Generally speaking, it's not that big of a deal. There are sometimes when you get, very specific pollen or pollen, very specific nectar sources, varietal honeys, things like that, where you might have something below 3.0 on your
pH.
pH meter,
Okay.
and then the yeast are going to struggle through that. But for the most part, a lot of that's coming through from the honey. You can also get that from fruit.
Okay. Same reason as,
Exactly. They're
vinegar and yeast and all that.
well, and the acid content of some fruit is just a part of the deal, especially like, citrus fruits,
Yeah.
right? Pineapple. The there's a little bit of the tartness that is just, it's part and parcel to the fruit. So you're adding some that way. Some people will also just add a little bit of, you know, acid blend or citric acid
to increase like that. So is there an alkaline? I know the opposite of acid is alkaline. Is there an alkaline you can put in to reduce your acid?
Potassium bicarbonate or calcium carbonate are generally added for that if you need to lower it. The potassium bicarbonate is generally the one that is preferred because calcium carbonate is, that's baking soda.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it has that baking soda flavor. That's
it
not.
It'd be salty, wouldn't it? A little bit.
A little bit.
Yeah. I'm not sure I'd want that in my mead, but.
Right. It's an off flavor. And generally the potassium ingredients are more flavor neutral. They're not completely flavor neutral, but we use, you know, potassium metabisulfite, potassium sorbate for that reason, because they don't contribute flavors that aren't already there.
Okay. I mean, I have that in my kit, but I've never used it, to be honest.
So the other like vector we can get these from, the like an acidic fault, is infection again.
So another bacterium or
right. You know, acetobacter is creating acid, and there are other like similar varieties of yeast, like, you know, lactobacillus and things like that, will create like lactic acid, for example, or pediococcus. There's so many damn families of very different bacteria that produce very similar but not quite exactly the same strain. So yeah, no, you can get.
Well, my sister-in-law is a chemical engineer.
Yeah,
so I don't want to know them all. She knows them. I don't want them. I don't want them.
Let her make some money knowing that. We don't need to.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so okay, so we got that. Now, before we go any further, a long time ago, Jeff and I were in a sword theater company, which my wife is desperately thinking about restarting, and she's going to be talking to you about that sometime in the future. And there, we had a mascot, and we had a favorite food for mascot. So today, because I saw them, I brought you a cannoli. There you go.
Aww.
Just for a little background, we did this. Our comic group was called Random Wit and Rip Your Twits. I know this is completely distant from what we were talking about. And our mascot was a narwhal. And its favorite food was cannolis. And the story of that is long and intrepid, and I'm not going to go into it here. But I saw one today when I was picking up bread and snacks for the show, because we have to eat something while we're having all this lovely mead. And so I grabbed Jeff a cannoli. So, because I thought it was a good gotcha for him.
That's fun. And it's bit tasty.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it. Hey, what we got next?
So, well, let's talk about controlling acid.
Okay, cool.
Obviously, there's a bunch of different ways we can get this, so there's a bunch of different approaches we have to use to prevent it in the first place, or when we're talking about it.
Number one, sanitize. Make sure that'll take care of as much as you can.
Anytime we're talking about infection, you know, good processes, sanitize, keep your stuff clean, keep your ingredients clean. Cool. We know that. We've talked about that. Mm-hmm. As far as vectors for like the honey or the fruit, you kind of just got to play that by ear and adjust for it. And this is one of those cases where if you're using a honey or a fruit that is more acidic than you are used to dealing with or that you anticipated, you know, me as a mead maker that generally tends to go like, you know, off dry, semi-sweet kind of range, I might go medium sweet to, you know, even on the sweeter end just to deal with that acid content. You kind of got to adjust and play it by the range there.
But if you go into the tart, I had a lovely comment from Jake at Bacchus. I showed him my bottle of wild plum I made recently. Mm-hmm. It was cloudy.
Yeah.
He goes, So instead of being wild plum, it's hazy wild plum. You're going to charge twice as much. I said, hey, I don't charge, but thank you. So if you have a tart, acid flavor, mm-hmm. and it's tolerable and you like it, call it tart.
Yeah. Lean into what you're talking about. I mean, there are some of these, and tart, I'm sorry, the acidic comment is going to be one of those where, you know, it is the question you need to ask for, is this a fault? Is this unpleasant? Is it acidic to the point where it is like too puckering for you to enjoy drinking it? Then it's a fault. Is it just tart?
Just tart.
That's not necessarily a problem.
And so if you're making me and you regularly eat Warhead candy, you may be in a bit of a pickle knowing if it's too tart for somebody else.
Look, there is a very legitimate like style of mead called sweet tart meads. people like those. They really do. And yeah, why not? If you like it too, lean into it. There is an audience for that kind of mead. Next on our list is alcoholic, and I think this is where those kind of diesel-y, this is one of two of those really we can get into. Part of that, this is especially like the flavor of the alcohol on a more alcohol or high alcohol fermentation. You know, we get into that 18 to 20%, you can actually just kind of taste
Yeah, you
the
have very distinct. This is
right.
hard alcohol.
It gets a little bit more like drinking.
Spirits.
Yeah, it gets a little bit more in the neighborhood of drinking spirits. So it feels thinner of body. It has more of that kind of alcohol fume to it. And we can also get some of the higher alcohols or the fusel alcohols that present this way too, because those are hot. They and generally they it takes very little for them to be perceived by the human taste buds and things like that on a parts per million or parts per billion scale. But generally speaking, how do you think alcoholic faults show up in your mead?
Too much sugars. I mean,
Kinda, yeah.
yeah. I mean, if you're getting, if I'm putting 6 to 7 pounds of honey in a gallon, I'm asking a lot from the yeast to begin with. And B, it's just all it's going to be is alcohol flavor for me.
Pretty much. And this is, you could kind of call this like over attenuation. There was a beer style a few years back called like a Brut IPA,
Yeah, I remember. Remember.
where basically like they had a, I don't remember the exact term for it, but they had a number of genes that could do, or a number of yeast that had a gene that could process, it was like an STA positive or something like that was the gene. But it could ferment more sugars than other yeast. And so it was really drying the beer out and it made this unique style. This is kind of that idea of, well, you know, beer makers say, hey, if you're going to put honey in beer, it's going to be drier because the sugar content of the honey is a lot purer than the sugar content of the malt they're using to make beer,
Yeah,
right?
that
So
makes sense.
it's kind of that way where the sugar went really high and it wasn't balanced after the fact. You know, a lot of the finishing of this, we do a little back sweetening, or we'll oak it or do something like that to kind of, it doesn't necessarily hide the taste, hiding
But
that.
it does leaven the harshness.
Right, and it gives it other things to compare itself to other than, you know, ethyl alcohol.
Yeah.
So,
And if you've ever seen any of the semi-recent social media posts, people trying grain alcohol, comedy is comedy gold. I'm not going to argue with you, but even Gen X didn't like that.
well,
It was still pretty bad.
no, I remember like in an age where I was not supposed to be drinking it, I had a little pint of Everclear that I used to mix with Gatorade,
Oh,
and that was not a good idea. But
that sounds like a horrible idea.
I know the blue ice doesn't taste good all by itself, and
No, I mean that's just right up there. Bad idea, right up there, putting Gatorade and caffeine pills together, just the other way.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that's like in my early 20s, we used to drink Red Bull and vodka in the club, and that's kind of
Oof.
in that same ballpark, right?
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, enough with bad choices from 20 years ago.
Yeah, 20, 30. I'm older.
There are other ways to get that alcohol flavor, and you know, the diesel stuff that we got from Rowan's experiment like a week or two ago, that's kind of in that same boat, right? One of the big ones is just like yeast stress or being outside of that optimum fermentation range. If you're fermenting a little too hot, that's an easy way to throw fusels. And we have an optimum fermentation range for those yeast to live in. That's not necessarily those yeast producing at their best for them. It's for us,
Yeah.
right? Some yeast are more prone to throwing, you know, the hot alcohols or the SO2, sulfur dioxide. That's the word I was looking for.
Okay.
But especially at higher temperatures, some are less prone to do that. So yeah, no, you get
So it's yeast stress causes that more than anything else?
well, no, It can be. It really depends on the source. If we're talking about fusels, that's generally either a stress or an undernutrition thing.
Okay.
So that could be temperature too high or outside of our preferred range. It can be a lack of nutrient, which I think was probably the case for Rowan's.
He didn't put nutrients hardly at all. So yeah,
Exactly.
he was just trying to the core experiment of what we've said of yeast, water, honey can make meat, and it can.
Yeah.
No, so the biggest prevention step you can take is treat your meat or treat your yeast right in the first place. So get them the nutrition we want, keep them in a temperature range that is comfortable or optimized for that yeast strain. And that may mean, you're brewing different meads at different times of the year because, hey, like we were talking about a few episodes back, Fike is great for the summer because you can just set it on your back deck in 90 degree weather and you get like tropical fruit flavors that are awesome, right?
Yeah.
And you probably, you turn that to compare that to like D47 that gets topped out at like 68 degrees.
Yeah, and you don't, and anything, if it's running hotter than that, the esters you get off that, you're never going to enjoy. You get a lot of vegetable, green vegetable esters, and
There are some that can be very nice if you're fermenting hot on D47
really, yeah, I
specifically.
have
Yeah,
not come across them yet.
Ricky from Groenfelden and swears by it, but it's a challenging opinion, and I've enjoyed it myself. I've enjoyed his meads. I've tried it myself and enjoyed the results. But yeah, no, it's weird.
Okay,
So.
but okay. So, I one thing: if you're going to make a mead and you want to control the temperature, my personal opinion is I keep it in my basement. If I need it hotter, I have gardening hot pads I put under the mead,
Right.
and I'll set it to whatever temperature I need, and I'll let it go, and I have a little bit of control.
Yeah. The trickiest part for me is controlling cooler than ambient, right? So I don't really have a good way to do that.
Neither do I. Best I can do is put it in my basement in the corner. That's
Right. If it needs to get cooler than that by a few degrees, you can do kind of like the swamp fan thing where you stick it in a little tub of water with a t-shirt over it. So the t-shirt goes up the material over the top of your fermenter, and you put a fan on it so that the fan evaporates as that water comes up. That I'm told can reliably get it like 5 or 10 degrees lower than ambient. It's better than nothing,
Yeah,
right?
better than nothing. I mean, yeah, but
I don't have a good way to do that.
but I, you know, I don't, I own a walk-in cooler to help with that. So,
Right. Yeah,
yeah.
yeah, yeah. On the other hand, getting it higher, we've got a few different solutions for that. We've got your little grow pads. We've got my sous vide stick in a tub of water that's just kind of circulating the water around. We've got the back porch and the shed, and we've got
And
options
Midwest
there.
heat.
Yeah,
Yeah, we got all kinds of that right now.
we're just getting into that, but
Yeah.
here we go. So yeah, no, fermentation temperature is one of those factors. Yeast health, nutrition, kind of thing. That's another factor. Also, just watch the amount of sugar you're putting into your meat in the first place. If you're the fact that you're using like K1V or EC1118 that can have an alcohol tolerance of 18% doesn't mean you reliably have to hit that.
And that was a big mistake I made early on. I was trying to get high alcoholic content,
Yeah.
and I was sacrificing flavor.
You really are.
Yeah, and you really are. I mean,
I've done the same thing, exactly the same thing. If I can, the logic of the beginning mead maker's brain is to look at this, EC1118. Oh, I can ferment up to 18% here.
and away
Then
you go.
do that.
Yeah, and away you go. But honestly, I have over the years I've learned, I've matured. I'm going for good mead that you can enjoy. If I get an 18 whatever percent mead, if it tastes good, I'm happy. If not, well, I have to adjust.
There's a reason that the recipes that I have provided to the Meat House audience here are 8% and 12%, because I think that's the lower and upper ranges of what I think is good for flavor balance, honestly. You could split the difference and go 10%, and I think you'd still be great in there. But I think between those two, you can generally get a good balance of, you get a little buzz at the end of the day, and you get great flavor, and you got so many options to do with those two building blocks right there. So that is my core thought process for why we have those two.
And honestly, when I make meats, I'll anymore, I generally keep it between 12 and 14. Sometimes going as high as 16.
Yeah.
That's rare anymore.
I mean, yeah.
But, and that's just my comfort zone.
Sure.
That's how I
And
whisper.
14% is not a it's outside my usual range, but it's not unheard of for me to try and hit that. So,
it even has the terminology in the mead community as a sack mead. 14 and above is a sack mead.
That's kind of where that borderline lies for a reason. Anyway, yeah, no, there's a lot of different reasons for the alcohol. You kind of have to have a little bit of a palate discernment there to determine whether this is something you want to fix. Fusels are hard to get rid of because they are one of those where, it takes a very small amount in solution to be perceived by humans. So they tend to be fairly robust. You can kind of age them out. You can kind of sit it on oak and let it kind of chill and calm out. They're still going to be there, but they get kind of
They're
lost in the
muted a
mix.
little bit into the background. They're
Right,
not
right,
as
right.
prominent. Again, from my experience point of view, if you don't let an alcoholic content stay low on the sugars, it's just gonna be easier for you to control it. If you want more sweetness or more alcohol, play with it if you need to, but just control your sugars.
There is also the problem of over attenuation that happens sometimes. Let's say, I know a number of people will go, okay, I'm going to put X amount of honey into my mead with the intention that the yeast is going to stop at 14%, and I'm going to have an extra 20 to 30 points as residual sugar afterwards for the sweetness. They're going to do it all at once. That's the wrong approach because sometimes the yeast will overperform, especially if you're treating it right. And so what you intend to be a 14% with, an extra 20 to 30 points of residual sugar can easily become a 15, 15.5% with maybe 10 to 15 points of residual sugar, right? You just don't plan it out that way. So that's why, again, the when I'm giving you guys advice on how to do this, how to do that, how to make a recipe, the sugar you put in, the honey you put in at the start is just enough to get the alcohol content we're looking for. Then you stabilize, then you back sweeten to the residual sugar amount you want in
And
the
that's
mead.
actually something Jeff told me early on was when it was first you're going to take it to dry, then we can correct is the word he used. Now Jeff likes dry more than I do. He knew I'd correct hard, and it works. I mean, I have much more control over it, and the alcohol content doesn't fluctuate a lot at the end of that,
Right.
but the flavor does.
And this is just a way to make a repeatable, stable process for you too, because that attenuation can, even if it's a 5%, a 0.5% difference in ABV, you're going to taste it.
Well,
You're going
yeah.
to feel it. It's a different thing. So this is a good way to make a stable process, a stable product, ferment to dry to get the alcohol content you want, then back sweeten for the flavor you want. That's easy. The next one, the next fault, cardboard.
The cardboard, I've tasted that before with you. In the early days of our show, we had one that had a distinct cardboard flavor. And I don't, what do you call that? I mean, what do you call that flavor? Just you call it cardboard?
Cardboard. Yeah, it's
Okay.
kind of a wet, papery. It's not pleasant.
No.
And realistically, cardboard is when I tell you the source of this, there are two different faults that this falls under from that one source. Cardboard, I usually when I was like trying people's stuff at Bacchus as a kind of a taster kind of a thing, I saw this more associated with beer than I did with wine.
Okay.
But this is oxidization.
Oh, okay.
So
I did not know that.
yeah, this is after primary fermentation, oxygen exposure can create weird flavors, weird unpleasant flavors. Unfortunately, this is another one of those where there's just no fixing it. Once it's oxidized, oxygen kind of just ruins shit.
And if you ever had a wine that it was really good when you opened the bottle, and a week later it tastes bad.
Hold your horses.
Okay. Is this different?
That's a different one.
Okay.
Yeah,
I know, same
that's
thing.
not cardboard. That's a different oxidization we'll get to later.
Okay.
That's the one that I find more commonly in mead and wine. But
It was also caused by oxygenation. Oh, wait, we'll get to it.
yeah, we're not talking about oxidization. We're talking about cardboard as a
Okay,
fault. We're
fair enough.
following the BJCP Mead Study Guide, which is a great resource for mead makers.
Is.
And yeah, so how do we not get cardboard flavors or oxidization flavors in general?
Going with oxygen.
Right. When you're racking, when you're moving from container to container, keep the pipe, the end of your racking cane tube, whatever, low and get it covered as soon as you can. If you've got the ability to do so, like a CO2 cartridge or something like that, blow some CO2 into the fermenter you're going to ahead of time. It's not absolutely necessary. It might help. There's also people will make like a little like argon gas spray you can put into a bottle of wine to like help it stay after it's been opened. You can use that. I've seen people use that in their fermenters too, just as a little
Okay.
something to keep the oxygen away from. But
Anything
splash,
heavier than oxygen that can keep make a barrier of some kind.
right. But things like splash racking, where you've got like a the flow of water or mead, whatever, is exposed to air and moving, that's almost guaranteed to give you some oxygen exposure to that the product there, whether it's a mead or a wine or cider or whatever.
So the less oxygen exposure you have to that, the less it's likely to happen.
Right. Yeah. Once you get past that primary stage of fermentation, you're at risk for oxygen getting in there and ruining stuff. Oxygen is great in that first like few days when the yeast is building up their colony and they need it. After that, you kind of want to keep it out. The other thing we want to think about here is closures. Whether it's corks or bottle caps or what have you, there's a reason the inside of that bottle cap has a like a plastic or a rubber kind of a film in there. That's an anti-oxygen barrier for that reason, just to
Okay.
keep it fresh. Corks do a similar thing. That's why I'm a big fan of the Noma cork, because it's a synthetic cork, so it's not as pretty as the standard one that we're used to, but they've put a lot of research and time into figuring out, hey, how do we keep oxygen out of this shit?
And actually, this can be using a natural cork or the synthetic cork, I learned again from you, is makes a profound impact on the amount of time you have before you shrink the wine.
Right, yeah. The lifespan of your bottled product is making a difference. I mean,
I mean, it's not a little bit, it's a lot.
Noma corks are, I think they are approaching but not quite the same level as like the bottle caps you get from beer. Your basic bitch little, pardon my language, but the most basic corks you get at your homebrew store, you got a year or two tops on those guys. And for some people, that's not a big deal at all. I can drink, five bottles of mead a month.
I can do. Let's go. No, but for people like me and Jeff that can make upwards of 10, 15 gallons, that's a lot.
Right. I mean, there's a reason I've mostly switched to doing 3 gallon batches, because I just can't drink that much, man.
Well,
I
you
like
need to make more friends.
I, part of the reason I was making 5 gallon batches for a while is because we were having regular like, game nights and parties and stuff where like, okay, it makes sense to have a tap. But COVID kind of changed everything.
Yeah,
So
meter rater.
the next quality here, and this is as vague as vague can be to me, is chemical. Yeah, you didn't see it, but Chris just made the most consterned and confused shrug.
I threw my hands up, going, "What the F?"
Yeah, because that can mean so many different
I
things.
mean, considering how many things we use, additives we use for our mead, I assume this is adding too much of something.
Generally, yeah, you're right on the money. And what we're talking about here, these are things like it tastes chemically. What does that mean? It tastes like, when you imagine like chewing a Flintstones vitamin. Everybody chews a Flintstones vitamin at
Yeah,
some
one time
point.
or another, yeah.
Without the kind of sweetness that goes with that, you get kind of that taste, or you can get a it's a little bit, I don't want to say malty, but it's kind of that, if you've ever tasted nutritional yeast on like, there's like a cheese substitute for like cheesy popcorn or whatever. It can kind of gets that sharpness to it. You can also get like it, sometimes it's just kind of a bitterness to it, or a almost a saltiness to it. Generally speaking, what do you think the excess we're talking about here is?
For salty,
For salty or chemically or what have you.
probably too much, like nutrient.
You're right on the money. Generally, this is nutrient that was added in excess. The yeast didn't have a chance to use it up before they basically finished their fermentation process, and you've got, excess fermate O, fermate K, DAP, whatever the hell, that just didn't get used up. And a lot of the times, this comes off as kind of salty, sounding kind of chemically. There are also some weird chemical interactions you can get. For example, using odd water sources, like if you use tap water and you don't treat it, you can get It depends on the source. It depends on a lot of other factors,
Yeah,
but you'll get
too much fluoride, too much
right.
chlorine.
You can get like almost a like a plasticky flavor, or the weird thing is it's the flavor that is the smell when you peel a Band-Aid.
Okay.
You get kind of that flavor.
Okay, so now I know what I'm looking at.
Right. It's weird, but that's generally an interaction between the fluoride or the I'm sorry, not fluoride, the chloride or chloramine in your water supply and the yeast strain you're using. None of them like that stuff. It's there for a reason, and the yeast are the reason.
Yeah, but I was just a few moments ago. I was going to say, I think everybody knows what a chemical flavor is. At
Right,
some
yeah.
point, we've all come across it in some capacity.
Right,
You've
but
licked a deodorant stick or whatever. But
why?
I don't. I haven't done it. But I've met
Sure.
odd people. I have a son.
I know your son. I'll
Okay.
give you that one. Okay, I've met
I was not the outgoing person that you see today.
your son.
But no. But we all have. At some point, tasted a chemical flavor that
Right.
we're
But
sitting here, you want to scrape your tongue after you're done. And that's what we're talking about.
Right. 9 times out of 10, that's either an additive or it's your water source not being pure. There's a reason I advocate so much for like just going to the store and getting the spring water jugs.
Spring water is great. Even if you have the place that have the reverse osmosis water, that's not a horrible choice.
Right. You just need to generally you want to add something to that, as far as like some kind of water salts, whether that's some calcium chloride or something like that, just to give it a little something to work with.
The spring water has a brighter flavor than distilled or reverse osmosis. That the brighter flavor is the minerals.
Yeah, minerality.
Simple as that. And it transfers to your meat. You'll get a brighter flavor with your meat.
Right. The for whatever reason, those the calcium and the other minerals that are included in that spring water, the yeast plays nice with. It just works for from a flavor standpoint. Anyway, the next fault we see in the list, cloudy.
What was it?
Cloudy.
Oh, yeah.
What's cloudy?
This right here.
Yeah,
Drinking it
yeah.
right now.
Our blueberry cinnamon today is cloudy. Why? This is not a big deal fault to me. This is if we're, if we're at the in a competition, we're looking at the score sheet. You get 6 points for appearance. I'm sorry, your blueberry cinnamon isn't going to score high on appearance because it's cloudy. It's murky even. But generally speaking, there's a few different reasons you're getting cloudiness. You can get cloudiness from like, the yeast is still in suspension, so it's not really finished fermenting. Sometimes it's like unfermented honey, whether that's from back sweetening or from just yeast didn't finish fermenting.
Temperature can make it cloudy.
Yeah, the chill haze is very much a thing.
My early days, and probably even today, because I don't keep it out much, but the first time I went to Valkyrie Horn, you saw my blackberry vanilla. I took it out of the car. This is in Minnesota. It was freaking cold. And it went from clear and beautiful to couldn't see through the bottle
Yeah.
because of temperature. These things happen.
Another one is pectinase. You get pectin in your fruit. You add the fruit and the pectic enzyme. The dosage you get on it is a general rule, not a hard and fast rule. So, like I just told Chris with his wild plum, and I don't know if it's made a lick of difference.
I put some in it and I left it in there. It's been a week now. I'm going to check
Yeah, the sometimes you need a double dose or just a little bit more.
And I so pectic enzyme is will help it be less cloudy because of pectic. Will it affect the flavor? Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, enzyme generally don't do much to the flavor unless
Oh,
that's
even
kind
the
of the
haziness will not generally affect. It will
thing.
affect mouthfeel.
Right, it affects mouthfeel a little bit. This is not that big of a fault, but generally those are your sources. It's temperature, it's not, aged or finished fermenting, or it's pectin. So I think we can pretty much move on. The next one, cloying.
Cloy, ah,
Well,
sweet.
too sweet.
Too sweet,
Excess
yes.
sweet. That's basically it.
Life event that happened with Jeff. Jeff's not a huge fan of Twinkies, unless they're deep fried, because they're not as cloyingly sweet, direct quote. And it just is. Too sweet is exactly that. Too sweet.
Right. Generally, you get to cloying by, you've either back sweetened too much or you put too much in on the first place and it didn't attenuate. or it just the yeast you chose didn't attenuate as well as it could have.
There is really no fix for oversweet. Find somebody who likes really sweet.
The best you can do is balance the other two legs of that table. And if you've gone way too far off of the cloying end, just like if you've gone way too far off the acid end, you may be SOL.
Yeah. I mean, so cloyingly sweet is too sweet.
Yeah.
And that's entirely up to you how sweet that is. But if one eye shuts when you drink a too sweet wine, you might be there.
Here is another weird one for you when we're talking about honey as a fault. Floral.
Oh my gosh. The guilty party I have is there is lavender.
Well, and that's one thing if you're adding lavender to your mead to make it too floral.
Uh-huh.
It, we've talked about this before. You can go from a pleasant little floral addition to, you know, the what is it, Lysol or Minwax or whatever they use at hospitals when somebody has a biological accident, real goddamn fast.
Really, really
or,
fast.
You know, grandma's perfume kind of levels of rose or lavender.
Wow, yeah.
It's real easy to overdo this. But what happens when that floral doesn't come from a flower?
It had to come from the honey.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
It had to come. That's the only other place it can come from I know of.
If a floral is unpleasant and you've not added flowers, it's got to be from the honey. And really, there's only one fix for that at that point. What do you think it is?
Mm-hmm.
Not a fix, a prevention step.
Okay, I have no idea what a prevention step would be.
Pick a different honey.
Pick it. Okay,
yeah. That's the best you can do. I mean, sometimes those... It takes a level of practice when you're getting into mead making, getting into recipe development, to taste a honey and go, okay, my best guess for what this is going to taste like when all the sweet is gone is this.
And that's a rough guess, because imagine a strawberry without sweet. Imagine a blueberry without sweet. Imagine watermelon without a sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Those things are not much in flavor after sweet. So honey is going to be just like that.
Right.
You're looking very hard for the underlying flavor. But when you find it, I mean, the first Valkyron I went to, a man brought 96 different types of honey we could try. And you go taste blind way before you'll get close.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, that's... If I were really ambitious, I could go through all 96 and decide which ones I like and which ones I go, there's no way in hell I'm going to get through those in a 3-day weekend.
No,
no,
you just can't.
No way.
After three or four, you're sitting here, I'm done. You can't taste the differences after that. There's just so much coming in.
No, but it is a great resource as judges, because I can say, hey, this is a Christmas berry blossom honey. What does that taste like?
And you go over there and taste the honey.
Right. You can taste the honey before it's fermented, so you know what kind of flavors it gives. And then you taste the mead, and it's like, I connect the dots.
But there you go. But by the same token, one honey I've never used, and I probably never will use, because I like lighter flavors, is buckwheat honey. It's really heavy.
Yeah, and there are, you know, Eastern, Western, there are different ones. I kind of like the funk of the Eastern sometimes, in the right context, but it is powerful stuff.
Yeah, it's a really heavy flavor. I won't use it for meat. I'll use it for my pancakes.
Fair.
But fair. I won't use it for my meat, because I don't like that heavy, heavy flavor in my honey.
Yeah.
For my meat.
And sometimes it's downright barnyardy.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But I'm going to put the cloying and the floral. Too much is too much.
Yeah. Well, and I think floral and the next one are very similar. Fruity.
Fruity. Okay, yeah. Same difference. You put too much.
There is another way you can get fruity flavors. But yeah, usually this is like you just kind of overdid it on the fruit, or you didn't balance it right. You know, sometimes you want a little bit more acid or tannin with a heavy fruit addition, or, you know, just the fruit in general is overpowering everything else.
And but, like we said last week, the blueberry cinnamon we had a few weeks ago, Jeff believes, and I'm taking his word for it, it was a fruit heavy, water light,
yeah,
base.
I feel like it was mostly from the tannin content than anything else. But it, you know, as we can attest, there's some difficulty in over fruiting a mead,
yeah,
right? So generally, when we're talking about fruity faults, that's not necessarily a fruit addition that's causing the fault. What you're more often getting in this case is you're getting esters that are getting those fruit flavors.
But you're going to get off a yeast that's been stressed in some fashion.
Right, we're back to yeast stress. So it's too hot. It doesn't have enough nutrition. The gravity in the meat is too high because you put too much honey in it. Or, you know, things like that. This is, again, yeast health will fix it. Unless you're trying to get those esters, in which case, you know, you're on the right track.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about faults, and ester is the fault, you probably don't want that.
Yeah. But, you know, honestly, there when I started learning about having esters come off certain types of meat, I started looking to get those esters.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another Olympic event right there in itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, well, you know, I'm trying to stress it just enough.
When we were talking about with D47 before, like, Ricky the Mead Maker gets some really interesting fruity flavors when he's fermenting that at 84 degrees, and the optimum temperature for that caps out at 68.
That's huge.
And you do get interesting fruity flavors.
Is that 18 degrees more? Something like that? 18, 20?
16, yes.
16, okay. Math fails. Okay, anyway.
Yeah, you can do interesting things with esters. There are so many different varieties of yeast with their own ester profile that is significant, and you know, the yeast has been selected for that ester profile. But they can also be harsh.
And as a beginning meat person, let's just try to avoid it. Try to make it clean.
Right. Use the guidelines that are provided for you to make things good, because you don't know. I think Ricky figured out the D47 thing either by experimentation or necessity. I forget exactly how that happened, but that's not the intention for the people that are culturing those yeasts.
Yeah.
So, you know, you use their best advice for a start. Goof around on your own time afterwards.
Yeah. And there you go.
So the next one, harsh.
Harsh. There's categories of harsh.
Harsh is another one of those that's really, what do you mean harsh?
Yeah.
Are we talking fusels? Are we talking, you know, it's too acidic? Is it too tannic? And generally it's, you know, it's one of those things. It's out of balance. This comes off as harsh with no other information is not that helpful to me as a mead maker, getting a score sheet back, you know, if it's, this feels too harsh, the acidic is puckering or the acidic flavor is puckering, and I can't drink more than two or three sips without wanting to, put it down and get a big glass of water.
Did that, you know,
tells me something.
Yeah. And I honestly, I've had to actually ask the one time I judged, I had asked them, specify what you meant right there. I didn't understand it. And for the most part, yeah, here, this is what I meant. And it was cool. But you should get the information you need to correct the harsh or whatever you need.
Next one, metallic.
Metal.
Metal. How do you get metal in a mead?
I don't use metal in my stuff much, so I have no clue. I've never had metallic come up.
9 times out of 10, if I get something metallic in a mead, and I'm tasting it for somebody, we're back to more nutrient than you needed.
Okay, too much nutrient.
Yeah, excessive nutrients. Sometimes this can also be from, you know, a weird quirk of your local water supply or your water source. Or sometimes it's just like, you know, your plumbing is starting to fail and you're getting, like, metal particulates in the water from your tap before you treat it and bring it in, and it doesn't settle out until fermentation. But usually it's excess nutrient
there. Okay, good.
That's the metallic taste that I'm most acquainted with.
Basically, the fix for that one is simply read the packaging.
Yeah.
Stick with what should be a good amount.
Yeah, again, follow the directions, use the either the packaging directions amount, or I really like my variation on the Toastin 2.0 I put out in a previous episode, where you figure out, okay, well, I've got this much honey or this much
gravity,
right? This much gravity of fluid, sorry, X much gravity of fluid in Y amount of fluid, so I need this much Fermate O or Fermate K or whatever. That to me makes so much sense, and I've never over-nutrient anything since I started doing that.
And no, don't be afraid of, you know, I have to get exactly the, okay, there's a little wiggle room. There is a little wiggle room with this without getting metallic or anything bad.
Right. Yeah. No,
there's not a huge amount, but there's some wiggle room. You know, this is not a lab where 1 gram of this is going to destroy everything.
Right. The perception level of these is not as strong as, like, fusel alcohols.
Yes.
You can get more in the concentration before you start to go, oh, that's that flavor. But this can happen. Next on the list, mold. Moldy. Mold.
Well, no, I can't imagine where that came from. You have sugar. You have moisture. You have a closed, dark environment. You didn't clean it properly.
Yeah, this can... There are basically two sources of moldiness, and the first one is obviously mold.
Somehow a mold.
This is a secondary infection.
Yeah.
Mold is in the same family as yeast. It's a fungus. It got in there. It kind of just did its thing.
And it got there first.
But not necessarily first. This can also be a storage issue. Okay. If your corks are kind of... There's a thing called cork taint.
Okay, I never heard of it.
Yeah, basically, your cork is semi-permeable, and it can get infected with mold and or another bacterium, and then you get a weird, funky, moldy taste from the moldy cork that's been in contact with your wine.
Which is another really great use synthetic corks. Mm-hmm. It's a really good use that. Also, when you're corking, do what Jeff and I do. We dip our corks in the star sand.
Yeah.
As we cork, we coat them in star sand before we cork, and that way, is it 100%? No, I don't expect it to be. I'm hedging my bets.
The little shrink wraps on the top of your bottle, those kind of, they don't completely prevent oxygen permeability or airflow or things like that, but they kind of help, and I find them useful for just marking what's what.
Yeah.
So, I kind of tend to use those more often than not to go, okay, well, this is my wife's sangria batch, and this is my weird cherry infected batch, so I'm going to do this in that color and this in the red color. And
that way I can reach and grab, and I've got the right one.
Yeah, tell them apart at a glance.
Me, I have everything labeled. I have initials on top of my corks, and I have a little label which I write on the side, and I have to search. So, that on me.
Yeah, the other thing that can cause a moldy flavor is we're back to oxidization. It's kind of that wet cardboard flavor. Can taste a little moldy depending on the ingredients too. But yeah, you watch out for your oxygen exposure. Watch out for your sanitization. You're not going to have to deal with this one. It's, unfortunately, there's no fix for moldy. Once moldy is there, moldy is staying.
And if the moldy is something you cannot drink, don't. Just pour it out. Clean your bottles better. Throw them away. Whatever you need to do. It's there to stay. Just get rid of it.
So the next one is a little more specific than harsh, but it is
still a little vague.
Maybe a little bit, but it's a wide breadth of characteristics. This is phenolic. So this can be kind of a weird spicy note. This can be that Band-Aid flavor smell. This can be smoke. This can be like clovey. This can be like herbal things ish. There are a lot of different presentations of phenolic in the
handbook.
Yeah. So, likewise, there's weird sources of this one.
Okay, fair enough.
For example, you know, spices can be phenolic.
Okay.
Or can be sources of phenols. Different yeast. Strains, varietals, things like that can be sources of phenols, but you can also get this from like wild yeast or secondary infections and things like that. You can get this from your honey source. I forget the honey source, but I had some kind of wildflower honey a couple years ago that you tasted the honey and you swear to God, Was the hive next to a tire fire?
Jeez.
It was smoky and kind of harsh and just,
rubbery.
And then that was before it was fermented.
Oh my gosh.
So after it was fermented, I couldn't imagine those getting any less.
And there you go. Don't use that honey.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, I'm not using this. But yeah, no, your yeast drink can throw phenols. You can get this from secondary infections. We're back to the idea of, you know, keep your yeast healthy. Keep your sanitization good, secure. You're not going to have to deal with this.
Yeah. And taste your honey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, make sure you like the honey first.
Right. Taste.
If it's what you get in the store, it should be fine.
Your meat is more than the sum of its parts, but you still have to taste the different parts and make sure you like the different parts you're working with.
Yeah, if you ate everything you're making, you're probably not going to like the results.
So next is the one that is the other oxidization factor that I see more often in mead and wine, and that's the sherry notes.
Sherry, if you've ever had a sherry wine, it's distinct. Mm-hmm. You're not going to mistake it for anything else.
Yeah. It has a kind of a, it's like acidy kind of,
acidy, tannicky,
right, earthy kind of. It. Some people really enjoy it.
My parents did. My parents love the heck out of it.
Sometimes in some meads, I can excuse it. I can say, okay, well, a little bit of sherry character here doesn't hurt. Feels kind of nice, actually. Sometimes it's just, more often than not, when I taste it, you know, as a judging perspective, a little goes a long way and a little goes too far. So, again, this is oxidization. So limit your oxygen sources. Unfortunately, again, when you get to this character, there's not a lot you can do to fix it. The damage is done. And generally, the other thing, you can look at a lot of meads until it's going to be kind of sherry in the first place. When you look at a mead that you can tell is supposed to be red, like a fruit mead, like a
cherry
or blackberry or something like that, and instead of red, it's kind of brown, and you see a little settling on the bottom. Generally, that oxidization is settling out, that's sherrying out, and that's,
you're going to get a sherry flavor.
Yeah, it's just. Again, the oxidization has spoiled it a little. So
yeah, there's a lot of things to talk about for things that could happen here. So
yeah.
This is the things we're fighting almost every match.
And again, sherry, there's not a lot you can do with it. This is a prevention, not a fix.
Next we have
solvents.
Solvents.
And this is that diesel fuel again.
Yeah, okay, this is where we're getting that diesel fuel thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is specifically, this is that hot fusel alcohol. You know, almost like sometimes you'll get like acetone notes to it too, mm-hmm. Depending on the kind of fusels your yeast is throwing.
Now, once upon a time I ran a paper route. Shocker. Guy on the paper route, I was the guy in the back rolling the papers for him. And you only do this once. As you're rolling the papers, you're getting ink on your hands.
Yep.
And you wipe your mouth and you will taste that. That is what the diesel is. That's what the acetone flavor is. That's what it is. You will never, ever forget it again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, how does this one happen? How does the diesel flavor happen? Is this stressed yeast?
This is stressed yeast.
Okay.
Again, this is yeast health. Get a good quality. Treat it right. Good temperature. Good nutrition. Don't underpitch. Make sure that you're sanitizing your stuff so you don't get secondary infections. That's
prevention.
Right. Unfortunately, fusel alcohols, again, they can kind of settle out over time a little bit, but don't count on it. It's not going to... probably not going
to
be the fix.
If you want to try to fix it, maybe throw a piece of oak in there and hope for the best.
Yeah, long aging, a little oaking, a little back sweetening can mitigate, but not remove. You might find it fixable. This might be a lost cause. A friend of my wife's, you know, heard we were doing a podcast. He's interested in mead. He brought me something to try that he had been aging for 6 months with the hope of, you know, getting rid of some of these fusels and things like that. And I'm like, okay, well, you've been aging this for 6 months. It's not getting any better. I kind of thought so.
And, you know, Jeff and I have both had that batch that we have to cry a little bit, pour down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
It happens. It hurts.
No one wants to admit to it. We admit to it because it's happened a few times and we are experiencing the shame of that for guys.
It's heart crushing. I mean, guys, I get it. If you don't want to tell anybody it's ever happened to you, don't. But if you're not careful and if nothing bad happens to you, great. But if you're not careful, something bad's going to happen. You're going to get to a point where this is not even drinkable and it has to go away. Mm-hmm. And take the loss, learn something, move on.
All right. Next in the list is sulfur.
Oh, God.
We're talking like the rotten egg.
Rotten egg and the pungent.
Yeah, that just struck match smell kind of thing.
Yeah.
Those are very pungent. They're very powerful. And again, this is one of those where it doesn't take a lot to be very noticeable, either on the nose or on the palate. Where do we get sulfur in the meat making process?
Only thing I can think of is it's in bad nutrition or...
You're out on the money.
Again, yeah.
This is stressed yeast. At the end of the day, generally this is a byproduct of autolysis, where the yeast has nothing to eat but more yeast, and so it's cannibalizing the yeast colony to
do its job,
right, to get the nitrogen it needs to complete its metabolism. And the byproduct of that, especially some yeast strains do it worse than others, but you get things like hydrogen sulfide or the sulfur dioxide. These are nasty little smells,
and I guarantee you, if you ever turn that into a contest, they're going to be really mad at you. It's harsh. It's bad.
It's not pleasant. And generally, like, even spelling that can give me a headache at the end of the day. This is one we do have a little bit of a fix for.
Okay, what is that?
Go to your hardware store, go to the plumbing section, and get like a little copper fitting.
Okay.
Like a little 90 degree elbow or just a little piece of copper pipe. Take that home. Get it real, real clean. I mean, get some rubbing alcohol and just get all the oil
Scrub
and
it hard.
scrub it hard underwater, blah, blah, blah. Just toss that in there for a couple hours in your meat.
And that could take out that.
Clean copper bonding with the sulfur will create a gas and will bubble out of the meat.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah, this is one of those where we actually have a fix for something that is harsh. Does it work all the time, 100%? Not really, but
Nothing does that.
you can get dramatic results from a couple hours, from what I've heard. So,
And if you leave it in too long, I don't think a copper's going to hurt a thing.
you want to rack off it at some point, but I don't think it's going to degrade into, whatever, different materials. I would pull it sooner than later, but if you forget about it, it's probably not going to kill you.
But
Maybe.
nonetheless, again, there sulfur is a possible fix for you.
Right. There's a little fix here. Hey, you know what the better thing though? Just don't do it in the first
Yeah,
place.
well, it's always the
Proper
case
yeast nutrition.
will eliminate a lot of your problems.
Right.
And the Kvek we talked about weeks ago is, if you ever decide to use that, and I'm getting ready to try to use that, is I'm going to be tripling, quadrupling my nutrients into my batch. I may be on the verge of over-nutrient it because that stuff is hot.
Well, the amount you're using really depends on the temperature you're fermenting at. If you are fermenting at ambient temperature, you can do one.
Well, ambient temperature in the Midwest is a variable.
Yes,
We
but
can get rain and heat wave in the same day.
let's assume we're talking about ambient temperature inside the house.
Okay.
We're talking probably
70, 75.
74, 75 on the top end, in the middle of winter, like 66, 68, probably,
Okay.
just for being comfortable. You can get away with like the package directions one time.
If I only put out 89 degree weather.
90 degree in weather, and you're definitely two, if not four. I usually aim at four, and I've not over-nutriented yet.
That's so yeah, nutrients are your friend, guys.
Yeah, know what you're doing, where you're getting it into. I mean, I think Fike is not necessarily advanced meat making, but it's an intermediate step, and
Yeah.
so you're taking more risk. You go into that understanding
Our buddy Tanner up in Minnesota,
that.
he actually, I believe he's the one that actually, no, what he might have been Tanner, but it was one of the guys up there. He actually made a racking device. He's an engineer. The mead never sees air through it. I mean, he doesn't open up anything, but he attaches one thing to the other thing to the where he's racking to, and it goes through the filter completely enclosed and never sees the light of day.
I know a number of people that ferment in the little 5 gallon pony kegs for the same reason, because it's so easy to do airless racking for exactly that reason.
Okay, what we got next?
Next is this is another one of those where it's like it can be a fault if it's too much
Okay.
sweet.
Sweet. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously you put too much money in either at the start or
Or the finish.
It's not balanced with everything else. Again, it comes down to balance.
Yeah,
I
and
mean,
it's
there's
and also what you would like. I mean, honestly, a friend of mine asked me to make her a pomegranate mead. When I got to the very end, I was about to back sweet. I said, okay, how sweet do you want it? And she was sweet. I said, define sweet. We have semi-sweet, we have sweet. And if you're really a glutton for punishment, we have candy sweet. She goes, can you do it a high candy sweet? I'm sitting here, I'll give you two bottles like that because I'm not going to ruin this entire batch by doing that much in the whole thing. It was a 3 gallon batch.
Right.
Well, if you're listening to this, Vexy, I still got those two bottles for you. So.
The next one I think is very similar to sweet, tannic.
Tannic, yeah.
Yeah, this is a problem if it's too much.
Yeah, a tannic is that grainy feel across the top of your mouth.
Right. Yeah, like you taste like top of your mouth, and it almost tastes like you're dragging it along sandpaper.
Yeah.
Not the texture, but
The feel.
the sensation of there is something holding me back, a friction there.
If you drink tea or even coffee, you're going to get that kind of tannic feel in your mouth.
So generally, if it's too tannic, there's like two sources of this we know, right? There's oak or something like that that is overdone, or there is tannin from additions like the wine tannins or
The
things like
wine,
that, or else fruit,
when they
like
got you.
blueberries. Lots of
Pretty
tannin, especially
especially in skins. There's a lot of tannins in those skins.
the wild blueberries that are itty bitty, so you've got a lot more skin to fruit ratio. You're going to get more tannin out of those.
Yeah.
If you've got a waterless blueberry, you might go over tannin
Yeah.
just for those
Just
alone.
a hit. Just a touch.
But again, this comes down to, hey guys, balance your stuff. If it's balanced, it's not a problem.
Acid, tannin, sweet. There's your three.
The next one, thin.
Thin. Well, yeah, this is it too watery?
Right. It's generally when you get thin meads, what you're actually seeing is not presence of water, it's presence of too much alcohol.
Okay,
It's an
yeah.
over attenuated kind
And this is okay. When you talk about, we talk about legs. We talk, every once we see, we'll swirl it in our glass, and we have legs. Legs are, you see little lines of the droplets going back into the bottom of the glass, on the glass that are not, it's not smooth, it's, they're thin lines. That's legs. I don't mind legs. That just gets, tells me it's a sweeter wine. If there's none, and you never saw any, it just, it film, and it was gone, it might be a little alcoholic.
The presence of legs is an indicator of alcohol, but it's also an indicator of like residual sweetness and body kind of components too. If you don't see those, it's going to be thin. It's not going to be, necessarily alcoholic, but thinness is, it's just the alcohol. There's not necessarily, the residual sugar or the other components that we think, is nice to it. Another thing that can get that thinness though is just using crap honey. Than kind of the grocery store cut with corn sugar.
From 50 different countries.
You can get weird flavors from some of those too, but generally you're getting, because it's just sugar, it doesn't really turn into anything but alcohol and CO2, and the CO2 went out your airlock. So
Yeah.
what you got?
So this is why we use honey, not white sugar.
Vegetal.
Oh, these I hate. I hate vegetal. I've never found a cure for vegetal flavor. It's these are the after flavors of, if I'm putting a flavor, if I have, say, for example, I'm making my blackberry vanilla and I put my vanilla, I put a vanilla bean. I normally make a vanilla extract. If I put vanilla beans in it and I leave it too long, I could get a green vegetable flavor. This is something that can easily happen. It's happened mostly with spices, I understand.
Spices are a big player in this because, the one of the biggest ways I've seen this is the steeping, if you will, of spices, whether we want to call this like a dry hop or a wet hop or a heat extract. However, you're getting this tincturing, you get too much of the contact time. And you start pulling things other than the flavors you're looking for. Those flavors you're looking for, depending on the context, whether that's a spice or an oak or whatever, those are generally gone from your sample, the subject thing in a week or two, maybe four. And then you start getting other stuff. And it's the other stuff that can be bad. Another source of these, especially some of the nastier ones, though, is it's another bacterial infection thing. You can get like a cooked cabbage or like either.
I'm sorry, first thing in my Porsche speed. Oh my gosh. Oh, no.
If you've ever had like an overcooked root vegetable kind of a thing, or you've opened a nice jar of green baby food and gone, it's that kind of flavor that you can get from a bacterial infection. So,
Yeah,
but again,
this is a preventative, not a cure on this
right,
one.
this is one of those prevents, and the prevent is healthy yeast at the end of the day. As far as the spices go, just stay on top of it.
Yeah.
Every couple of weeks, you got to pull that, replace it if needed, taste it.
And as a general rule in spices, for me, I use dry spice. There'll still be oils in it. You can overdo, but I have a little bit better control, in my opinion, with a dry spice rather than going out to my garden picking rosemary.
Anything wild like that, I tend to go tincture. I like the tincture just from the A. It's really hard for bacteria to infect 40% alcohol.
Point.
to 99% alcohol if I'm going to go crazy and use the ethanol corn, you know, rocket fuel shit.
Yeah.
B, like, I can add that by the milliliter and get just real fine tune on that flavor without a lot of like sitting and waiting.
Mm-hmm.
So, God, that's a nice thing. Does it work for everything? Not really, but
if you had the option, take it.
Yeah, I'm playing with it more and more and trying to figure out where it works and where it doesn't. From my
my vanilla tincture is 60-70% grain alcohol.
Yeah,
with vanilla beans in it, and I let it sit for literally months. I have one 5 years old now,
mm-hmm.
So it's powerful stuff.
We're getting down to the wire here. Last few. Waxy.
I don't know how you get a waxy flavor in mead unless I dipped a candle in it and let it melt for some reason. What causes waxy?
Generally, it's a honey varietal kind of a thing.
Okay.
Yeah, there's just some honeys are not particularly flavorful, but they have a kind of a waxy character to them. Sometimes this is also just like an oxidization or other kind of weird yeast health kind of issues. But for the most part, it's a honey varietal character. So
no M&M honey.
No M&M honey.
No M&M honey.
Yeah, yeah. You want to, if you get this kind of thing, this is one of those where you can't fix it. You kind of just got to, okay, don't use this honey anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes.
Last one on the list. Yeasty.
Yeast. Okay, well, obviously you didn't use too much yeast got into it, and you didn't kill it all.
Or you just didn't let it finish.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't think about that, but there you go.
Yeah, I mean, really, at the end of the day, this is, hey, you may have hit your target ABV, but that doesn't mean your yeast has hit its target nutrition. There's still stuff working in here, and it's not done. Sometimes you just got a hazy strain of yeast that doesn't like to flocculate, where it kind of all settles down to the bottom. You might want to switch up your yeast strain. You might want to, you know, give your yeast the time it needs to finish its ferment, but...
Again, backspeeding. Don't stop the batch. Control what you want at the end.
And once you're done, once you're satisfied that the yeast is actually done, you know, use things like clarifying agents, finding agents like I was talking about, or filter like Chris was talking about.
I use both.
Yeah. I don't feel the need to filter hardly at all. And so I've never bought a filter. I've never really pushed it. But you can. I'm not going to stop you. I'm not going to tell you you're a poser for doing it. I just don't feel the need to. Honestly, I get pretty stellar clarification just on super clear and then, or dual fine. Or
dual fine.
Yeah. It used to be called super clear and then they changed the name.
Okay. Well,
so I keep forgetting. It's
Ketosol and.
Chitosan and Kieselsol.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah.
But the fine agents, the clay, the. Do a fine,
mm-hmm.
Do a stellar job, man.
Yeah.
The only thing you have to do at that point is not suck it back into your batch
right.
when you're racking.
Yeah. No. The polish. I'm sorry. The filtering step is widely regarded as a polishing step, and that's exactly how I see it. I just don't feel the need to polish it myself.
And you don't need to polish something for you to have at home for yourself.
Exactly. I know a lot of winemakers will do that to present a very nice polished looking product, but I'm not there. I don't, you know, if my friends don't like my mead, well, fine. I'm not going to give you more.
No, yeah. That's just mean. Anyway.
Well.
All right. So that's the end of our list.
That is the end of our list. And oh my God, have we been running for a while?
Yeah. We don't usually run this long, but we had a lot to go over this time.
Yeah, we did. And so I think we wanted to be thorough about it. We wanted to talk through these and I hope this was useful to you guys.
And if it isn't, my apologies. We're not going to bat 100 every time.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, Chris, let's call this good for now and see you guys next week.
See you next week.